Good morning, this is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is Jack Brighton, glad you could listen today. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about how modern technology has changed our sense of identity. Our guest is Lawrence Friedman. He is Marion Rice Kirkwood Professor of Law at Stanford University and the author of many books and articles on American legal history and the relationship of law and society. We'll talk with Professor Friedman during this hour about his latest book, The Horizontal Society, published this year by the Yale University Press. In the book, Professor Friedman describes a fundamental shift from what he calls vertical societies, in which identities and relationships are based on clear lines of authority and tradition, to the horizontal society, in which men and women are freer to form whatever identities and relationships they choose. And as so often is the case where human beings are concerned, the outcome of our choices in this new horizontal society can be good or bad, depending on how you look at it. And in Professor Friedman's view, if I'm not mischaracterizing it, the civil rights movement was a product of the horizontal society, but then also the ethnic genocide in Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia are products of the horizontal society. We'll ask him to describe this thing we're calling the horizontal society, the forces that drive it, and the implications for our social, political, and legal life during this hour. As we talk with Lawrence Friedman, you're invited into the conversation. Questions are welcome. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455 or toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, if that makes it easier to remember. Also, toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Professor Friedman, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Please, to start, could you describe the change you refer to as the relative shift from vertical identities to a horizontal social structure?
Okay. If we begin with a kind of idealized picture of a traditional society, let's say it's a village in medieval Europe, people who are born into that society are born into a specific place. They learn their place in society from their family. There are very clear lines of authority. And what's most important is they really have very little exposure to the outside world. In such a society, identities are formed very early, and they're formed in a way that people don't question. They're not very fluid. And basically what's happened in over the last century and a half, but more and more rapidly as time goes on, is that technology has made it possible for us to have much more fluid affiliations. Now, of course, I'm not saying that people don't have families anymore and that they don't pay attention to traditional authorities like churches, governments, and so on. Of course they do. But the existence of television, the internet, cyberspace, travel, movies, has made it possible for people, in a sense, to choose, or to at least to think they're choosing, new forms of affiliation. And I try in the book to explain how out of this comes a lot of things. What you said is quite right. I don't characterize this as good or bad. That is, I think many things that happen as a result are, in my opinion, quite good. The civil rights movement is a perfect example. But the kind of extreme nationalism and ethnic identity is also a product of this movement, and I don't think that that's good, and I don't think many people would disagree with me. Now, in what way are these things connected? Well, I'd like to start with by drawing an analogy. Out of the history of criminal justice and other subjects I've dealt with. The first penitentiaries that were built in this country were built on a silent system. In, say, 1840 or so, in a place like Sing Sing, the prisoners were housed one to a cell. So there was solitary confinement. They were not allowed to speak. They never, if the system worked, and it did at first, they never spoke to another living being. They were just in their cells, they were allowed to work, and so on. Now, without going into the details of that system, it's very obvious that in a system like that, you can't have a prison riot. You can't have a prison riot because the prisoners cannot communicate with each other. It's a completely non-horizontal system. The modern prisons are quite different. 90% of all the prison riots have occurred since 1960. I mean, in order for people to form affiliations, whether good or bad, they have to have ways of communicating with each other. And the modern methods of doing that permit it. And you can utilize those methods to join a society that's interested in collecting old milk bottles. You can become a militant feminist. You can become a militant nationalist, and so on. The modern dictatorships, I might add, are made possible by their ability to mobilize a population and to manipulate that population through modern means of communication and so on. A classic autocrat like Louis XIV simply couldn't do that, and indeed had very little interest in doing that, since the vast majority of his subjects were peasants who were inert and who rose up against them only in times of famine and so forth. And so on. I mean, so that's the essential argument. It follows from that one other thing, and then I'll cease this monologue. Is that in a horizontal society, all identities are, in a way, chosen. Now, I have to be very careful in the way I state this because it's very easy to misunderstand the point I'm making. I don't choose to be a man, and a woman doesn't choose to be a woman. We would say, of course, those are inborn strategies, inborn statuses that we have no power to change. But in fact, we can choose to be, we can choose not to be a man or a woman, but we can choose to make that the center of our existence, to be militant about men's issues or women's issues, or to make it relatively unimportant to us. We can choose to make our religious identity central, or our ethnic or our national identity, so that in a very important social sense, all identities are chosen. Now, I do want to add one caveat. When I say they're chosen, and this is a point on which I'm often misunderstood, and I can see why, I'm not saying necessarily that these choices are completely free. They're not free in the economic sense, and they're not free in a sociological sense. I'll give you an example of this. Most people would say in the United States that they absolutely choose what they're going to wear. That this shirt that I'm wearing is one that I chose. Nobody forced me to buy it. I picked the color. I picked the style. Now, of course, any decent sociologist would tell you that your choices are constrained by powerful forces that you're not even aware of, that are forces of your time and your place and your culture. And that's absolutely correct. And in fact, is at the very core of my argument, but also central to the core of my argument is the idea that people think they are choosing freely, whether in fact they are or not. And I think that's a very essential aspect of our culture. Well, I don't know if I've done justice or mercy to my book, but that's some of the argument. Yeah. I chose to make.
Well, there's a lot to talk about in there, and I want to kind of, you know, pick a few points and ask you to elaborate a little further. This process of connection, you use the analogy of the prison where people were formerly isolated, and now they're connected. They can communicate and form, you know, a community of, you know, they can form a book club or a prison riot. It's totally up to them. This process in the world stage, essentially is made possible by technology.
Right, absolutely. I mean, it's made possible by the fact that within a country, it is possible to communicate instantly. That's the essence of horizontality, as I define it, that you can reach like-minded people in a way that you couldn't before. Incidentally, when I started writing the book, I had never even heard of the Internet. By now, the process I described has become even more extreme because of the fact that people all over the world communicate by email. They form chat groups and so on. And that's the ultimate horizontal form of forming connections.
Right. You also focus a great deal on television in the book. The couple things you say I think are very interesting. Television has completed the process of breaking down the barriers of time and space that separate people. And, you know, extending from your previous comment, I think the Internet has furthered that. You also say television hasn't eliminated local cultures, but it has transformed them into modern local cultures and turned the world into a single linked system of culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. There's a paradox here in that television makes possible the development and the strengthening of local cultures. At the same time, it kind of homogenizes them and links them together. I mean, one example of that, I speak in the book a lot about language. Now, most people don't think very much about the history of their language. Every modern standard language is a standard which has been imposed on the vast majority of the people who speak it, who in fact spoke different dialects and different ways of speaking. And in many countries, the standard language was the language of the capital. It was the French of Paris. It was the English of London. It was, you know, it was Martin Luther's German. It was the Swedish of Stockholm, and so on. And the local dialects, however, persisted. And in your village, you just spoke your local dialect. With the coming of first education, school curriculum, and then very much so television, the individual variations within the culture are blotted out, and a single standard becomes much more uniform. At the same time, broadcasting in, say, Italian solidifies a sense of Italian nationality, of Italianness, as opposed to, just European or other countries. So television makes possible the formation of a giant horizontal group, the nation, which also means the blotting out of small subnations and differentiates the nation from other possible horizontal groupings. I mean, television all over the world is doing that. The other point that I made is that it creates dialects, but they're modern dialects. That is, many people who travel are struck by the fact that you can see a program. You go to Italy, you turn on TV, you see something very much like Wheel of Fortune, but in Italian. So what it does, it links all the cultures into a common world mass culture, with the only difference being that of language, although that's a very important difference.
Sure. In what you were just saying, one thing that I'd like to ask you to amplify a little bit on is the development of national identity, which may seem to us here at, you know, almost the turn of the millennium, like, you know, there have always been nations, people have always been, you know, English or French or Chinese, etc. But even this notion is in essence a modern notion and isn't, I mean, isn't a long-standing thing that people have thought.
Right, absolutely. I mean, it's a very complicated topic. There's lots of exceptions, but I think it's fair to say that the general trend is that before the last 100, 150 years, there really weren't nations. in the sense of groups of people that felt strongly that they belonged to a nation. And there's a book that I cite. It's a wonderful book written by an American historian whose name I'm really not sure how to pronounce. His last name is W-E-B-E-R. I think he calls himself Weber. It's called Peasants into Frenchmen. And he just attacks the question of when did French national identity come into being? And the answer, which I think would surprise a lot of people, is almost amazingly recently, that in the time, in the middle of the 19th century, there wasn't any sense of French nationality for the vast majority of people who lived in France. They were just peasants living in villages, and they knew their village. Some of them had never heard of Napoleon, for instance. And they didn't speak French. They spoke another language or a dialect that was so different that they couldn't understand Parisian French. And they just, they weren't French. I mean, there was a French government, but the majority of the people did not think of themselves as Frenchmen. And how did this change? Well, Weber describes the building of roads, forming of a national army, compulsory education, imposition of the French language. And I would add to that then, later, movies, TV, and the media, which create a sense of identity among the people in this country that simply didn't exist before. And out of this identity comes nationalism. And the nationalism is a sense of belonging to a nation. There's a feeling of patriotism and so on. And it really depends on the ability of people to identify. And that ability, in turn, depends on a communication, a sense of communication. Otherwise, your identity and your identification and your allegiance is to some smaller group, a clan, a tribe, a family, a village. So without the means of mobilizing a population, of being able to communicate with a population, then there can't be any real sense of nationalism as we know it today. So nationalism is also a product of the horizontalization of society.
First through the roads and then through broadcasting
right,
everything
movies,
else.
TVs, the media, and so on, and et cetera. Now, at the same time, somebody will obviously say, okay, and now we're entering a period in which these same processes may be globalizing, internationalizing, breaking down national boundaries, and that may well be true. It lies, I think, largely in the future.
Sure. Well, at the same time, there, you know, you refer to the emergence of a kind of global uniculture, in which real communities based on geography decline and virtual communities emerge.
Right. I mean, this is it's quite incredible, the spread of a single culture. I mean, anyone who's traveled a lot over the period of years has noticed that while people are still speaking Finnish in Finland and Chinese in Hong Kong, that there's an amazing similarity in what people eat, what people wear, the movies they see, the music they listen to, which is being spread all over the world. A lot of people talk about American influence or Western influence, but I simply think it's the influence of a modernization that is the spread of a single culture through these means of communication and transportation. People are traveling more. Before the jet airplane and middle-class tourism, most people never went anywhere. I think as late as 1960 or so, less than 10% of our population had a passport. You just stayed at home, or you went to the nearest national park, or maybe wandered as far as New York or California. But to go abroad, this is something new. And it spreads a kind of world uniculture.
I want to ask you to talk a little bit about the technology itself as part of that global uniculture, because it seems that it's not just the message that the medium conveys. You know, perhaps, you know, I'm not sure if this is an update on Marshall McLuhan, the medium is the message. But in essence, when we use modern communication technologies, television, the internet, when we're global travelers by virtue of transportation systems that can take us anywhere or can communicate with anyone anywhere via just the telephone or whatever. I mean, how does that affect our own sense of identity and our feeling of connection with other people? And doesn't that sort of have embedded in it certain cultural assumptions?
I think it does. It does embed in it some certain cultural assumptions. Let's take television, for example. There's a lot of controversy about violence on television and this and that. I think, I guess I'm going to sound a little like McLuhan here, that the most important message of television is not anything in the content of any particular program, but the central message of television is a message of individual choice, of consumerism, of material goods. Television is about entertainment. It's about it's commercial. It's highly commercial. It's fast. It's vivid. It's glitzy. It's entertaining. Its primary messages are: be a consumer, be an individual, buy. And these are extremely powerful messages that are spread all over the world. And the language differs, and there are variations. But these underlying messages are extremely important, and they transform the culture. They transform every culture in the world. Now, of course, there are variations there. There are cultures that are trying desperately to resist, like Iran or China to a certain extent. I'm dubious about how long they can resist this very powerful culture. I don't particularly applaud all of it. I think most of what we're conveying around the world is schlock, but I think it's almost irresistible, and people really seem to like it. So there develops a kind of uniculture, a mass culture. Let me just add one thing that I hope doesn't deflect you from this. I earn my bread as a teacher of law. Mm-hmm. And so far, it may seem that we've wandered very far away from the legal system. But in this book, I do try to talk about some of the impacts of what I call the horizontal society on systems of law and authority. And, I would like at least have that mentioned at this point.
Okay. Well, certainly, and I'll try to ask some relevant questions at least into that area. You just mentioned the resistance to this mass consumer culture that we see in places such as Iran, Afghanistan, and even in the United States. I mean, there are people who are trying to sort of opt out of that, you know, that identification as a, you know, one consumer among billions, etc. But I think you say something very interesting about this, and maybe you can put a fine point on it, and that is that even the resistance to modernization can't escape being part of modern culture. It has to use the same tools, and therefore it's, you know, even when we try to turn back to tradition, we say we're turning back, you know, to earlier modes of culture. They're not the same, and they can't be.
No, that's right. One of the many paradoxes of modern life is the whole notion of tradition. The idea of tradition is modern. Now, that may sound crazy, but a lot of people notice, you travel to Europe and you see a beautiful cathedral, and it says it was built in the 15th century, and in the 15th century, King so-and-so wanted a cathedral there, so he tore down the 10th century cathedral. Now, today we would consider it to tear down a 500-year building to put up a, now we love the 15th-century cathedral, but we have to realize that they tore down an old, well, why didn't they think it was worth preserving? Well, because the whole idea of tradition and preserving tradition and being traditional is essentially a modern notion. The idea that one has a kind of tradition that has to be honored is something that is just that doesn't exist very in the past. I mean, this is the whole idea of historic preservation, the process by which what we used to call swamps are now called valuable wetlands. It used to be considered a great boon to fill in a swamp. Now we talk about it's the breeding place of the rare so-and-so. So the whole idea of tradition is relatively new. When it comes to national traditions, there's been some wonderful work done. There's a book by the British historian Hobsbawm, which he edited, called The Invention of Tradition, which he shows that a lot of the so-called traditions, like the Scottish plaids and tartans and so on, and a lot of the hoopla surrounding the coronation of the British monarch, are completely modern. They're not traditional at all. And this is understandable. If nationalism is something distinctly modern, then the creation of the idea of a national tradition, national customs, honoring of these, is itself very modern. And so in the process of developing nationalization, you develop a sense of traditions that really didn't exist. And the idea of returning to an older tradition, even among fundamentalists, is something which reflects these distinctly modern trends. Another thing about fundamentalist movements or movements in places like Iran is that necessarily, and I don't fault them for this, they have to use the same tools as their enemy. Now, you can't fight an army that has guns with spears. So their weapons are the weapons of mass media, mobilization of the population, and so on. They have to fight for tradition using non-traditional methods because there is no option. Otherwise, they've simply lost.
So the tradition they're reviving is, I mean, it's not, even if it existed in the past, it's now been updated in a new horizontal arrangement.
Right. It has to be rephrased in modern terms. Yeah. It has to have modern dress to it. It has to use the weapons of modernity. There's no alternative to that. No culture can survive unless it adapts in that manner.
The other thing this relates to is ethnic identity, which is another thing that we see being asserted very strongly in places and very violently in some. And again, you regard this as a modern construction.
Right. Well, it is a modern construction, and it depends on the creation of a kind of sense of oneness among people who wouldn't necessarily think of them as one. I mean, if you think about something as Serb nationalism or Albanian nationalism, it depends on convincing a bunch of people that one of the primary aspects of their identity is not the fact that they're male, female, their religion, their interest, their occupation, or anything else, but that they should pivot a lot of their mental and physical energy around the fact that they are Albanian or Serbian, as that's defined now. Now, that's by no means self-evident. I mean, it can be and, in fact, is manipulated by leaders, often unscrupulous leaders. I mean, there are so many stories of people in, say, modern Yugoslavia who say, my mother was Serbian, my father was Croatian, we have Albanian relatives, but now we're expected to make a choice because, well, the war has erupted and so forth and so on. But all of this is kind of artificial construct, which is done through the mobilization of the population using modern methods. And in this case, I think the results are wholly evil, but in other cases, they may be benign. I think the formation of a civil rights movement, of a sense of kinship among, say, members of racial minorities has had a tremendous and, on the whole, extremely salutary effect in this country. The same thing is true for the women's movement, for the movements of the so-called sexual minorities. The beginning comes from a sense that they have some commonality. And often this depends on some extremely simple means of communication. It leads people to think they're not the only ones who have a particular opinion, and there's a chance, a choice, an opportunity to join with other like-minded people.
Extending this into the realm of universal human rights, as you do in the book, and maybe we're finally getting to an area of law here, this is another product of the horizontal society, you argue, is made possible by, as you suggest, simple means of communication, and maybe the atomization of culture into individuals and you know, reasserting their rights and looking around and saying there are other individuals in my same place.
Yes.
Let's all agree that we have universal human rights.
Right. And I also think that this idea of universal human rights, traditionally in political theory, it's traced to this thinker and that thinker, and as if it were a matter entirely of political philosophy. But I think that 99% of the people who feel that they have a right to freedom of speech and so on haven't the vaguest idea what John Locke wrote and so forth and so on, and couldn't care less. What happens is this sense of right comes from individualism. And the individualism, I mean, to oversimplify, I'm sure, is fostered by these means of communication and transportation that emphasize the individual choice, the fluidity of individual identities, and the sense of being free to choose what you are. And all of this spreads around the world. There's a kind of debate as to whether these rights are essentially Western and they don't suit the societies of the Far East and so on. I think that's complete baloney, because they're not really Western anyway. They didn't exist in the Middle Ages. They didn't exist in, say, Russia in 1900. They're not Western, they're modern. And they're modern and they spread in the way that I think I've described. So when Korea becomes, to take one example, becomes a modern country, a prosperous country, a country with television sets, a country with a middle class that travels about, then the pressure for it to democratize, for people to enjoy basic human rights, becomes irresistible. And you don't have to talk about them being imported or imposed by the West. They're imposed through the action of the population itself once it's been exposed to the same forces of modernity that transformed, say, Belgium or Finland, but a little earlier.
We have a call to talk with. Let's go ahead and include them in our conversation. We have just about 15 minutes left with Lawrence Friedman. He's professor of law at Stanford University, author of the book we're discussing, The Horizontal Society. If you'd like to join us in the remaining time, you can call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a listener in Urbana, line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello, I just came in from a meeting, and I don't know if you got to this before, but I'm Jewish, and I think that the idea of being a nation is very traditional and goes way back, and also, but it's unique among the idea of being a nation that the a stranger is always welcome. And there's always a, and even the slave had a opportunity to be free, and a lot of the temporary problem with my speech, but
it's okay.
A lot of restrictions that women suffered in other societies did not hinder Jewish women. So there has always been a seeking after social justice, as well as a sense of nationhood that makes us separate, but not to shun the stranger, but be kind to the stranger. And I wonder if you've explored those themes in your study.
I couldn't say I explore them. I do mention it. I do mention that issue. When I talk about nationalism being essentially modern, I'm painting with a broad brush. There is a literature on and the sense of the Jewish nation, which is ancient, is something of an exception, and is a very interesting phenomenon. There was also a strong sense of citizenship in the Roman Empire and so on. But this had all more or less fallen apart in the Middle Ages and in the early modern period. And the Jewish sense of separateness was kept alive by the ghettoization and the prevalent system of anti-Semitism. That there is a literature on exactly what Jewish nationhood meant in ancient times and so on, and it's an involved question. But I think that nationalism in the modern nation state sense is something quite new. I must say, I have to differ with you. Obviously, in the prophetic tradition, there is a strong striving towards social justice, but it's a social justice which is not understood in the same way we understand it today. If you talk about women, but of course in the Bible, women really, although they were to be treated with respect and so on, had a distinctly subordinate role, a role that would not be accepted by modern feminists in any way. And that was at that time, and until very modern times, there were very strong notions of the differences between the social role of men and women. And that's breaking down now, as you undoubtedly know. So I think that while there was a strong sense of social justice, and that you find it in other classic civilizations also, it was understood in a way that was quite different from the modern understanding, which rests on the individual, regardless of their inborn status.
We have another call to talk with. I hope the last caller will forgive me for moving on, but we're
sure.
Going to run out of time, as we do so often, very quickly on the show. We'll go next to a listener in Crete on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, Professor Friedman. A couple of questions. One involves the war crimes trials in Nuremberg and Tokyo after World War II. Mm-hmm. Many maintain, and Robert Taft was one of those, that these were ex post facto proceedings and therefore stood against everything that we as a nation supposedly represented. And the second question is, was this internationalization of society, we're going to have an internationalization of criminal justice as well, looking at the push for tribunals, mm-hmm. for people who were massacred people in Rwanda and in Indonesia. And we also have this individualization of crime at the same time.
Yeah.
When we can take Noriega out of Panama and drop him in Miami, and we can take Pinochet out of Valparaiso and drop him in Madrid, hopefully, at least some would like that. So I would like you to talk about this whole proceeding over the last 50 years, a change in international law.
I've never had very much sympathy for the argument that the Nuremberg trials were ex post facto. If you think that, you're taking an extremely narrow legalistic view of what a crime is. That is, since the Nazi leadership didn't define what they did as crimes, then therefore they're not crimes and they can't be punished afterwards. Just think of what the alternative would have been, to just let them loose. Well, I think they wouldn't have lasted very long. They would have been murdered very quickly by the tens of thousands of people whose lives they had outraged and managed to survive death camps, slave labor camps, and so on. I think that the Nuremberg trials reflected the fact that there was a growing consensus that there were some action. Sure, laws differ from place to place, and, you know, pulling a label off a mattress may be illegal here and legal someplace else, but that genocide, waging aggressive war, and other acts of that sort were simply not acceptable. Now, I've never had any problem with that, and I think it does depend on the development of a sense that there are standards of human rights which don't vary from place to place and which are indeed independent of the particular legal arrangement. Just as in this country we have constitutional government, which means that never mind that the majority is willing to through their legislators are willing to pass a law that offends what we consider basic human rights, it's not going to be allowed to stand. Now, internationally, I think we are developing a kind of common sense. There are signs of the internationalization of criminal law. It's very primitive up to this point. Pinochet's problems are, in a way, a fluke that a judge in Spain accused him of crimes that were committed against Spanish citizens, happened to be in England at the time, which is a member of the European Union along with Spain, and so on. There's international war crimes tribunals and international tribunals. I think on the whole it's a good thing, and that it will develop. The U.S., by the way, is extremely resistant to any such idea because we don't like subjecting ourselves to international authorities. But I think, you know, no one can predict the future, but I think that there's such a growing consensus among people as to what all human beings have a right to expect, that that we can expect some eroding of national sovereignties along this line. I think it would be a good thing, but that's just my view.
Okay. We have about 3 and 4 minutes left. We have another caller I'll include before we're out of time. This is a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. This is probably a different tangent to this whole thing, but you're speaking reminds me of the book The Alphabet and the Goddess by Leonard Schlain. Are you familiar with that book?
No, I'm afraid not.
I think you would be very fascinated by it because he looks at how the development of written language affects the whole dynamic of how cultures develop and how matriarchy was and right brain thinking was predominant until we started written language, and that and paternalism and patriarchy then developed as left brain thinking developed. One of his theories is that as we are getting more into computer use of computer and doing both using both hands in writing,
mm-hmm.
On the computer and so forth, that we're getting more and more egalitarian,
mm-hmm.
as we are, as the right and left brains are both being used more.
Well, that's very interesting. Yeah. I didn't know about it. What was his name again?
Oh, I'm sorry.
We
lost the caller because we're running real closely in the time. Leonard Schlain, Schlaine, I believe. We actually had him on the show a few months ago.
Uh-huh. Sounds interesting.
Yeah. The Alphabet and the Goddess, the name of the book. Well, we just have a couple minutes left,
sure.
and there's so much that we haven't had time to talk about, and I'm really sorry about that because there are a lot of great ideas in the book. You know, we're talking about the formation of these various identities, whether they're ethnic or national, et cetera, made possible by the horizontal society. I guess as a way of finishing up, I want to ask, you know, we're talking about essentially imagined communities.
Right.
And these imagined communities are a product, so to speak, of imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And so our own imagination creates connection with others who we imagine are like us or we are part of a group that they contain. And it seems to me that once we imagine that we can imagine any community we choose, even one that is very complex, even one that is global.
Right.
Is that where we're heading?
Well, I'm always leery about saying where we're heading because we can look like we're heading there and then suddenly something deflects us in another direction. But, yes, it does look like we may be heading in that direction. But, you know, as I said, when I started writing this book, I had hardly even heard of the Internet. Nobody had. And I'm just amazed at what it's doing. And I just can't even guess what the world is going to be like in 20 years if it continues along these lines, which are, I think, extensions of what I've been talking about, that is, people getting together and forming groups of a certain kind in ways that are so much more rapid and easy than before. And so it may be that, well, distance doesn't seem to mean anything anymore, and that's bound to have an effect on the culture, global culture. But exactly how, I really couldn't say, but we know it's true. I mean, I know last year I had to send a message to someone who was in my building, and the only way I had, they were visitors from Singapore. The only way I could communicate with them was through email, and they kept their Singapore address. So I sent a message to someone who was 100 yards away from me, and they went to Singapore and back in, I suppose, 5 seconds or maybe less.
Yeah.
And I think this is something amazing, and I hope I'm around long enough to write about what it does to the world and to the world community.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that since we're here at the end of our time. I can only suggest for folks who'd like to read more on this topic, look for the book The Horizontal Society. It's published recently by Yale University Press, and the author has been our guest, Lawrence Friedman, professor of law at Stanford University. And Professor Friedman, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Jack.